Hello and welcome to the AXA Growth Leaders series. I'm EJ Flynn, and in this series we're presenting talks from entrepreneurs and prominent thinkers on leading the future workforce. Today we're exploring how and why investing in health and well-being for your teams is not just something big corporates should invest in. It should be high on the agenda for any business that wants to be successful, because we know that healthy people make healthy business. However, in this hyper-connected, high-demand age, it's all too easy to find excuses not to prioritise switching off and improving both your mental and physical well-being. So where on earth do you start? Well, in this episode, I'd like to present a talk from AXA's recent Growth Leaders event, the keynote speech from brand pioneer Liz Earle, who shared her story of how she's woven well-being into every aspect of her business journey, from founding her world-renowned skincare brand Liz Earle Beauty in 1995 to the present day with Liz Earle Wellbeing. Now, whether your business is in the well-being space or not, it doesn't matter. There is something in this for every business, and I certainly came away with loads of tips and ideas. So without further ado, let's head to the stage to hear Liz Earle recorded live at the Royal Institution in London.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I work in the world of well-being, and I have worked in the world of well-being for the last 30-something years. Obviously, I started as a very small child. So I thought I'd go back and just give you a little bit of history about who I am and how I came to do what I do. So this is me. You may know me more for creating a skincare brand. And I think that's probably one of the things that happens when you put your name on the tin and it flies, is that you become ever associated with that one product. But I actually started out my life as a journalist 35 years ago, writing for women's magazines at a time when health and beauty were being first connected. I was interviewing these strange new breed of people called nutritionists and complementary health therapists and practitioners. And I absolutely loved it. I had various things going on in my life. I had very bad skin, for example, and I wanted to get that sorted. So I used lots of dietary techniques, which were quite new at the time. And that really started my whole journey and passion into health and well-being, and I have just continued it ever since. And it's really great to be back in this space doing something that is, as we can see from all around us, such a huge global industry. I'm sure many of you are working in well-being with companies at the moment. But everything that I've done has always really been based on trust and authenticity. And I think that's also the key message that comes through with well-being. There's got to be credibility and trusted information, because there's so much noise out there. And I think my background as a journalist has really taught me to go after the facts and to chase the true story and the bottom line. So I started in magazines. I moved very quickly into books because I'm quite greedy when it comes to words. I like writing 70,000 and not 70. So books give you the platform to do this. And my very first book, with a slightly dodgy haircut, was called Vital Oils. And that was really written at a landscape when the whole world seemed to be going low fat, no fat. Most of you are probably too young to remember a lady called Rosemary Connolly, who had the hip and thigh diet. And the whole premise of that was that you cut all fat out of your diet and you lose lots of weight. Well, that may happen, but also your skin falls apart, your joints fall apart, it's very bad for you inside. So I wrote this as a backlash to that, really, saying, no, we shouldn't be demonising fats. Partly sugars are the baddies, but also it's the bad fats. So it's the processed damage fats, the hydrogenation, the trans fats. I was nearly sued by a well-known low-fat margarine manufacturer for daring to suggest that their polyunsaturated sunflower trans fatty acid spread could potentially be harmful. And now, of course, trans fats are removed from processed foods. So I feel that was a bit of a tick in the box. So that's been my message really all the way through, is this credible, reliable information that improves our own health and well-being. And it's still very relevant today. I moved from writing books into doing TV. I was on the launch show for This Morning with Richard and Judy, which is actually 31 years ago this year, really quite terrifying. I mean, I can't imagine what I was talking about 31 years ago with any degree of knowledge and authority. And I'm still back on this morning these days, only it's with Holly and Phil, with very much the same message. And I think what I've found through business is that your message needs to be consistent and strong and true and not vary from it. It's very hard to create an artificial history, and I think customers and consumers resonate with authenticity. So I love communicating. If people say, you know, what do you do? I kind of think foremost, I'm a communicator. I love writing books. I've got a podcast series called Wellness with Lizelle, which I love because it's me getting the opportunity to talk to the leading brains and experts in so many areas of well-being. Lots on women's health there, lots on mental health. So how did I get into beauty? Well, I went from magazines into books into TV. So that gave me a bit of a name and a bit of fame and became known for, hopefully, trusted, reliable, credible information, particularly about ingredients. And I think ingredients are the bottom line. Whatever business we work in, we are the sum of great ingredients. And these days we're weaving in even more stories of sustainability and eco-credentials. You know, back in the day, nobody asked me about my carbon footprint. Green was just a colour on a shade chart. It wasn't a political statement or a way of living. But I just felt instinctively drawn to the more natural world. My father was a great gardener. He was an admiral in the Navy. And whenever he came home on shore, he would head to his garden. That was his grounding. That was his foundation. And he and I used to connect over growing broad beans. And he's a very practical man. So he loved plants that do things. And I think I inherited that from him. I love medicinal plants and plants that make a difference to life. So this was a series I did on ITV called Lizelle's Lifestyle. And I would sit in my bathroom and I would mix up lotions and potions and have guests on. So this was a very early shot, actually, of the young Gordon Ramsay. And I have to tell you, he was the sweetest man. He did not swear. He wore very high-waisted jeans, a bit like Simon Cowell, which he constantly sort of hitched up. And that was one of his first TV appearances. He had a restaurant, a Michelin-star restaurant in Park Walk called Aubergine. And he came on, and I think if you go onto YouTube, there's a clip of that. And it's quite interesting because he is very sweet and very smiley. And then I saw him about a year later on TV. I thought, oh my goodness, Gordon, what's happened? Anyway, so that was my background. So I was doing all of this when my girlfriend said to me, you know all about skin, you know about ingredients. Women trust you, they recognize you. I think you should be creating a skincare line. And my first reaction, if I'm really honest, was, oh, don't be ridiculous. You know, I'm a journalist. I'm not going to do anything that's commercial. And she said, well, that's fine. We can do it together and it'll be a sideline. I mean, famous last words. Of course, it became, when we sold it back in 2010, it was one of, if not the biggest independent beauty brand in the UK. So I went into the lab. I'm not a chemist. I know lots of chemists and I know people who can do this. But what I know is about the power of plants and how to use particular ingredients and particular nutrients. I'd spent some time with the BBC filming at Harvard, looking at antioxidants when that was Walter Willetts and that whole kind of research team were beginning to explore the power of antioxidants for well-being. So I knew that there were various forms of vitamin E, for example, that would work well on the skin, and that's what would go into the creams that I wanted to put my name on. And it's a very interesting decision, isn't it? I don't know how many of you here actually have your name on your brand, and it's a two-edged sword. In one way, it gives you instant recognition and people either, you know, buy into you and love what you do or they don't. It can be quite polarizing. Hopefully they love what you do. But it also means that you absolutely have to be possibly even more transparent and trustworthy and authentic than if you were an unnamed brand without an individual. And if I'm ever mentoring or talking to groups of young business people, or maybe people, older people, I was working with much older CEOs recently, and they were looking at finding purpose in companies. And I said, well, just ask yourself this question and ask your teams, what would you do differently if your name was on the brand? How would you approach it differently? What would you want to stand up for? What would you be prepared to be taken to task for or be questioned on? So it's quite an interesting business discussion as to whether to put your name on the brand or not. This was a kind of lie me down and fan me with a hat moment, because this was the Vogue Millennium Edition, which is a collector's item, if any of you have it, from December 1999. It's got a gold cover with just the word Vogue written on it, Millennium. And they had one page of iconic beauty products. So they've got things like Chanel No. 5, Clinique Dramatically Different Moisturising Lotion, Elnett Hairspray, the old, the greats of the millennium. And then right at the bottom, there's the Lazar Cleanse and Polish. And we were unexpecting that. That was an extraordinary moment. And it was quite prophetic because the product did go on to become, and still is, the number one best-selling cleanser. But the awards and things that I'm more proud of, actually, I mean, I love the products that I created, even though I'm no longer connected now. But the awards I'm more proud of are customer service, because that's how we engage and retain, whether we're retaining employees within our own teams, but obviously going out and growing brands. And that's never more important than it was now. When I started my beauty company, the landscape was very different. It was very polarized. You had big glossy brands in department stores behind counters. And then you had the much cheaper self-selection skincare in Boots or Superdrug or wherever. Now, of course, there's this whole range of what they call mastige, the mass market and the prestige, coming into this middle market, very often authored by names and faces or smaller brands. And of course, we've got social media, which we didn't have. So I think customer service is absolutely key. It's one of the things that I've always really focused on. And in my teams, even to this day, now with a small startup, we'll have a meeting and there'll be a spare chair around the table, and somebody may come in late and go to sit in the chair. I say, no, you can't sit there. And they say, well, there's nobody sitting here. Why can't I sit there? I say, no, the customer sits there. Everything we do around this table, everything we do in this room is going to affect the customer, which affects the brand, which affects our bottom line. So really always thinking, what does he or she think about this decision? How is he or she reading this or viewing this price point or this packaging or this communication piece or whatever it is? So really chasing happy customers is, I think, what the well-being of brands is all about, because happy customers drives profit. I've never been particularly financially profit-driven, profit-aware, obviously, but not necessarily driven. I'm driven by chasing happy customers. These days, I'm chasing happy readers and happy listeners, but it's the same thing. All of us want to chase happy, healthy customers. So building what was a brand kind of foundational on a few very simple skincare products, we went global. And it's really hard, isn't it, when you're growing and scaling a brand to keep those authentic principles. And it's really, really important to do that. And we would have, you know, key messages that would go across everything. Obviously, you've got slightly different languages now with social media. You will be phrasing things differently on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook. That was something I learned quite early on. I thought in the early days with social media, you just put one message out there in the same tone of voice. And of course, you've got different audiences reading things in different ways. And personally, I don't do a huge amount on Twitter. I find it quite shouty. But I do love Instagram. I've got quite a big and growing Instagram family. And I think the whole idea of creating pictures, and we're seeing more of that, aren't we, now with Instagram stories and videos, and the power of the podcast for getting messages across. You know, more and more brands are coming into podcasts. And what I love about podcasts is that it's all about content. You know, whereas we've had the rise of the bloggers and the vloggers and the people posting all these lovely pictures, is there any substance to that? You can't podcast without content. You can't podcast without really something to say and a great way to say it. So for me, podcasts are really where it's at. And it actually took my young millennial team to bring that home to me. My team at the moment is sort of slightly split between the older, maybe wiser, more experienced, certainly, people in the team like myself who are in their 50s or even older, and then the younger millennials. And we work really well together because they're very switched on and very forward-going, bringing new ideas all the time. The issues tend to be they tend to be fickle and easily distracted, so we try and sort of bring those two aspects together. But keeping the core principles and just translating it into whichever message is how you need to build a strong brand. So I think consumers are very aware, but everything is very transparent, isn't it? It's very accountable. You know, if you don't respond to something on Twitter really quickly, then it can blow up and people say, well, I tweeted you 20 minutes ago. Why haven't you responded? You're hiding something? What's going on? Whereas in the old days, obviously, we used to write letters and have weeks and weeks to respond. So it is a tricky thing. And I think you can only manage social media well if you're prepared to be totally transparent and authentic. So that really comes down, I guess, to who to hire within your firm. These are some of my early botanists who I worked with. So I did actually recruit from the Chelsea Physic Garden. I used to go on medicinal plant courses and find interesting people who were interested in the same things. And this is another lesson that I've learned actually about how to hire people who will help the business to grow. And it's all about attitude over mindset or over experience. And I'll give you an example of this. My son, eldest son, wanted to be a commercial airline pilot. So being the mother that I am, I thought, well, I better do my due diligence on this and find out what his career prospects are and who he could go and work for after he's done his training. So I went to a very famous airline and I said, you know, what aeroplanes does he need to fly? What experience does he need to have when he's working on simulators? Just tell me what he needs to do so I can make sure that he has the right course. And they looked at me and they said, oh, well, he doesn't need to fly a plane. I said, no, he's going to be a pilot. Okay, so he wants to fly a plane and come work for you. He said, yeah, no, we can teach him to fly a plane. What we care about is how he thinks. And that really struck me. And that's a lesson that I've learned in my business when I'm recruiting. Obviously, it's very easy. You go on CVs and you look at experience and does somebody fill all the gaps and they've got the right experience on paper, but are they going to think the same way? You know, I can train and mentor and give experience and guidance, but I can't change the way somebody thinks. And I've made some bad hires in the past because of that. And now, hopefully, I'm making much better ones and giving people opportunity to grow and to develop. So working within a team internally and also externally, because teams are built not only on the inside with people who work with us, but also our external community. When I was building the beauty company, I was really fortunate in that I spent a lot of time overseas working with developing countries and developing communities, very often with women's groups. This was a group of shea butter growers in Uganda. And they were just so thankful to partner with us and so committed to providing great ingredients, which in turn created great products, which deliver a great message, a great story. It's just a win-win-win for everybody. So thinking broadly about the well-being of teams and communities, both inside and out. People are also looking for a purpose. You know, this is something that we're hearing more and more, isn't it? Purpose-driven businesses. How do we engage our customers? They recognize that they have a pot of money. How are they going to spend it wisely? They're going to choose selectively on brands who have the purpose that they resonate with. How are we going to retain great employees? How are we going to motivate people to get up in the morning and want them to help us drive our own message and our brand by giving them a sense of purpose? Why are we doing what we're doing? What's the point? Really having a purpose-driven business is something that I feel really strongly about because it builds resilience. And as we all know, we're facing huge times of change and never more have we needed to be resilient. So purpose-driven businesses, I think, are really important. And this whole sharing and exchange of information is just such an exciting thing and I think is a real business asset. So managing change and having a sense of purpose actually builds really great well-being and resilience into businesses. So moving on into well-being. So I sold the beauty company back in 2010. My business partners and I sold it first to Avon. I was retained in the business for a while. I then exited. The business is now owned by WBA, Walgreen Boots Alliance. It's part of the Boots family, and I don't have any connection to it. So when I was thinking, what am I going to do with the rest of my life? I'm not ready to go and sit under a tree just yet. And realizing that well-being really is where it's at for all of us, both in our workplace, business opportunities. They say the wellness market is valued at something like $500 billion and growing. It's the fastest growing consumer sector. But also fundamentally, it's something that clearly affects us all. We're all growing older, hopefully, and we're going to want to live well, not just live long. Live long and prosper, I think somebody said. I can't do that funny thing. So when I went back into startup mode a few years ago, I went from running a team of 1,000 to running a team of 3 we started off with. This was quite interesting to think about going back into print. People were going digital. The age of the magazine was dead, we were told. I don't believe that. I think that we're certainly bucking the trend with new niche quality titles are doing really well. And again, it comes down to authenticity and tone of voice. I think one of the best-selling titles at Hearst is Runner's World, because, you know, if you are a runner, you will read that magazine. So it's about having that niche, that authenticity, that trusted voice. And it is a big space. You know, there's a huge amount of noise on well-being. And, you know, trust me, I've been doing this for 35 years. I've seen a huge amount of fads come and go. And I was, you know, writing about kale when it was called cabbage back in the day. And so, you know, there's very little that I haven't seen. And it's great to be part of something that is standing the test of time. But there are also some very interesting new things which I'll come on to, which I think are very helpful. But in a whole world, I think, which seems to be going online and digital and ephemeral, it's really interesting to see that there are certain cases of print really coming up to the fore again. And there's a resurgence, I think, in this element of trust and tangibility. You know, I've done interviews which have just been terrible, and they've gone online, even with reputable publications, and we've called up the journalists and they've gone, oh, don't worry, we'll change that. And it's just changed online in a flick of a switch. Well, we can't change this. Every single word in the magazine has to be true and trustworthy. It's gone to print. And there's something very focusing when you do that. And I think consumers are realizing that actually there's something to be said about the printed word and its trustworthiness. So what I'm trying to do in building my small team, we're still quite small, is build resilience and strength and well-being into my own team. Obviously, I've got to kind of walk the walk and not just talk about it. So we do team yoga and stretching. We have a Pilates teacher. We tend to do well-being Wednesdays in my studios in Battersea. So we get a well-being Pilates teacher who'll come in on a Wednesday and just stretch us out. You know, it's obviously we try and have ergonomic desk setups and all that thing so that people can work smarter and be better. We try and be creative. So we'll take time out. This was a pottery workshop that we went and did in the East End of London. That was great. It was a really, really fun day. We spent a lot of time learning about each other, because as you're molding this stuff, you know, the conversation was just flowing. And I learned a lot more about my team in that single afternoon than I'd learned in the months previously. And the things that were on their minds and creative ideas that were coming to the fore. It was a really great afternoon, time very well spent together. Also having a sense of fun. You know, this is something I've learned from my young millennials is, I think because as an entrepreneur, like you guys, you know, I am very driven. I tend to be quite serious and very focused. And I think my younger team teach me to lighten up and to share the journey and to enjoy the ride. And certainly as I get older, that is something that has become quite important. And doing lots of team building. It was interesting seeing the agile working, flexible working. I just wish I'd had that when I first started in this business world. You know, we didn't even have email. That's how old I am. I had to write my first books without Google. My kids kind of look at me and they say, but Mummy, how did you know anything? And I say, well, I used to go to the library and talk to people. So I love agile working. I find it very good for the well-being of my team. They love it. I don't necessarily want them to schlep in on an hour-long commute and arrive frazzled and exhausted and poorer. So we do a lot over Skype and FaceTime and Zoom and all of those things and sharing Google Docs. I'm really happy to have my team away working, and that comes down to trust. Doesn't it? And it's, you know, I know a lot of companies, the bigger companies, will want people to be in the office. They can see what they're doing and they're monitored and overseen. You know, frankly, if you trust them enough to pay them, you need to trust them enough for them to be working at home flexibly. So I'm a big advocate of that. And I find that it helps people to stay mentally sharper, physically stronger, and more productive. So one of the things that I've learned over the years is about gut health. This was a book that I wrote a few years ago called The Good Gut Guide. And this came out really because I was interviewing lots of different people in the world of well-being for my magazine and my podcast. And whether I was talking to a dermatologist about skin issues or an oncologist about the latest chemo or people about rheumatoid arthritis or food allergies or mental health issues, whatever it was, everybody was coming back to the microbiome and talking about gut. I thought this is a huge new strand of medicine that is new and significant. So I hooked up with various researchers. There's the British Gut Project at King's. There's the American Gut Project at Harvard. There is so much happening. You cannot fail to have noticed the rise in gut. And interestingly, when I first mentioned this to my publishers, I'd signed a 3-book deal with Orion. And because they wanted me to focus on beauty, because that's what they were kind of, you know, putting me out as, they said, we need some beauty books from you, Liz. So I said, okay, fine. So the first book I wrote was called Skin, and that you know, did quite well. And I got really into this, the whole gut health thing. So I said, listen, my second book, it's got to be about gut and gut health. And they said, oh, yes, okay, so we'll call it Inner Beauty. I said, no, we'll call it Gut Health, because this, and they said, you can't, nothing, it won't sell. No, you can't put gut on the cover. And it's really interesting, isn't it? That was, I think, 4 years ago now. And of course, now everything is talking about gut health. Why? Because it works. It really, really works. And the very interesting research linking the brain and the gut, linked by the largest nerve in the body, the vagus nerve. We now know that we have brain cells in our gut. We have neurotransmitters that fly up and down, telling our brain instinctively what to think before our brain rationally processes it. Gut instinct is an extraordinarily important thing for business. I've ignored my gut instinct at times when I shouldn't have done. And the reason why we have expressions like butterflies in our tummy or gut instinct is because our gut can tell us things before our brain processes it. I remember I hired somebody once who on paper, again, coming back, he looked brilliant. And it was a time when I really needed to fill this slot. But there was just something that was nagging me in the back of my mind, and my first impression just wasn't great. And I overrode those gut instinct feelings, and it turned out to be a very expensive mistake. So I don't do that anymore. I do listen to my gut. Not to say to make snap decisions, because I've also learned to sleep on decisions. And I often say to my team, you know, if it has to be now, then it has to be no, because I need time to process it. But I will always take great care to review my initial gut instinct on something and then rationalize it with an overnight decision. So really important to look after gut health. So what do we do? First thing, drink kefir. Does anybody here drink kefir? Yeah, we've got one or two early adopters. Great. Kefir is a superfood. I don't use that word lightly. It's like a supercharged yogurt. If you could imagine yogurt wearing kind of Superman underpants, this would be kefir. It does so much for us. It's a very easy thing to add into diet. I'm not very good person at giving stuff up. I'd rather add things in. I think it's more positive. And kefir is something, we'll always find lots of kefir on the go in the studios. You can buy it now, even supermarkets stock kefir. You can make your own. Very easy. I've got teenagers at home at the moment doing A-levels and GCSE. They are fueled by kefir. It's very good for mental health, brain development, obviously all the gut health issues, IBS and food intolerances and acid reflux and all of those things. But just helping to produce serotonin in the gut that can then help us to sleep better. You know, these are really simple things. So, you know, stock your work fridges with kefir. Go to lizarwellbeing.com and you'll find there's recipes on how to make it. You don't even need to buy it. It's extremely cheap and easy to make. The other thing that you'll also find in my studios is sauerkraut. Again, cheap as chips to make. It's just chopped cabbage with a bit of water and some salt, and it pickles, it ferments. You can keep it for months. Again, it's something you add in. So wherever you are, you can add it into your food. You can add it into sandwiches. You can add it onto baked potato. You can add it, you know, I had roast lamb at the weekend. I was serving it with krauts and kimchi and all these different things. So whatever you do, try and have a portion of fermented foods on the go. And again, my studio fridges, you know, if you open them up, you'll find lots and lots of jars of sauerkraut. And this is what we tend to do actually on a Wednesday. Usually after Pilates, we'll have a bring and share. It's a well-being lunch. And there'll be lots of fermented food on the go. And it's a chance to talk about food and a chance to share. And I think some of our best conversations and best decisions come over a shared meal together. And people love to contribute. They love to bring things that they've made at home. And very often the conversation will turn to gut health and to microbiome. And that also actually segues into stress and managing stress levels and decisions and workloads. So it's a very easy way into actually talking about how the health of the team is, taking the temperature and the well-being of the team that you're working with. This is also really important, a great business asset, underrated, the importance of sleep. I've written quite a lot about sleep. The optimum level seems to be 7.5 hours a night. Not much more, not much less. You can actually have too much sleep. Don't work all week and then crash at the weekend and sleep for 12 hours. That's not what we need to do. We need to get up at the same time pretty much every day. So even though it goes against the grain not to have a lie-in, I do still get up at the same time at the weekends. I'll grab the papers and go back to bed with a cup of tea, but I'll be active in my brain. Sleep is fundamental, isn't it? We can't make good business decisions without proper sleep. And again, sleeping on a key issue is really important. If it has to be now, it has to be no, I need to go to bed, my brain needs to process it. And just on a fundamental health and well-being level, we know that when we sleep, that's the time that the body is doing its repair work. We know through circadian rhythms and how our cells work that our skin is repairing, our body cells are repairing. Really important for entrepreneurs and business leaders to prioritize sleep. And above all, just this is the message that we need to be giving our teams and ourselves. Find your happy. And it is really about that. We know that happier teams are stronger. They are building financially more resilient, more creative, more profitable organizations and more successful brands. And we're actually having a lot more fun in the process. So I look forward to continuing the conversation. But for now, thank you very much for having me this morning.
A huge thanks to Liz there, speaking live at the recent AXA Growth Leaders event at the Royal Institution in London. It is so brilliant to hear Liz's journey. I love how well-being permeates every aspect of what she does, from customer experience to the way she's built her teams. And my gosh, I absolutely need to fill my work fridge with sauerkraut and kefir if that's the one thing I've taken away today. So if you enjoyed Liz's talk and want to find more out on this subject, and also how AXA PPP Healthcare can help support your business, then head to the AXA PPP Healthcare website and search for the Growth Leaders Hub. And if you'd like to attend our next event, featuring Twitter's European VP Bruce Daisley as keynote speaker, then that's happening in London on Wednesday the 10th of July in the afternoon. Bruce and our brilliant panel will be discussing what technology can future-proof your business and how you can manage and motivate the talent of tomorrow. The event is co-hosted by The Supper Club and you can secure free tickets from thesupperclub.com. That's all for today, so until next time, thanks for listening.